I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. The most thankless job in America may be that of a big city school chief. Today, Arnie Duncan joins us to talk about the job of running one of the nation's largest public school systems, Chicago Public Schools. It is one of the only systems under mayoral control, and its innovations are legion. But is Chicago getting results? We'll find out from its CEO, Arnie Duncan, today on Smart City. Also with us is Eric Schwartz. He is president and CEO of Citizen Schools that mobilizes thousands of adult volunteers to provide after-school apprenticeships for middle school students. What will it take to get better education outcomes for our kids? We'll talk about that with our guest Arnie Duncan and Eric Schwartz today on Smart City. But first, the news. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Arnie Duncan is Chief Executive Officer of the Chicago Public Schools. He was appointed to run the 435,000-student school system by Mayor Richard Daley in 2001. He graduated from Harvard University in 1987, where he was a first-team academic All-American basketball player. He played professional basketball in Australia for 4 years, where he also worked with children who were wards of the state. He returned to Chicago in 1992 to direct the Aerial Education Initiative to create educational opportunities for inner-city children on the city's south side. In 1998, he joined the Chicago Public Schools. Why is it so hard to improve student performance in America's urban schools?
I think historically, the lack of achievement and the lack of success that school children have seen across urban school districts in America has not been the children's fault. It's been the fault of school systems. It's been the fault of adults. And many school systems, quite frankly, I think have been set up for failure. I think part of the reason you've seen such remarkable change and progress here in Chicago is simply due to the structure. 10 years ago, Mayor Daley took control of the public schools, put his entire reputation on the line. I report to a board, an appointed board that can see the big picture and has a vision and can make the tough decisions. We've been able to bring in a great management team and put in place strategies that you can stick with over the long haul. Because of the instability in so many school systems, the average tenure for my position is like 2.5 years. That's simply crazy to me. You can't begin to have an impact in that short amount of time. And so I think structurally, in too many cities, public education has been set up for failure. And that's one of the reasons I'm so grateful and thankful to have the opportunity to work here in Chicago. We absolutely have the chance to succeed, and that isn't the case in other places, unfortunately.
Are you saying, Arnie, that if the structure is right, that students, in fact, can make the gains that they need to make?
Absolutely. And we've seen children, you know, in the poorest communities, very tough backgrounds, do extraordinarily well when given great academic opportunities where there are the highest of expectations, where they have long-term support and long-term guidance. I worked in the inner city for many, many years before I came to the Board of Education. So I know in my heart and in my bones how much our students can do despite humble beginnings and humble backgrounds when given real opportunity. And that's our job every single day, is to create those great opportunities and give the children the long-term support they need.
Do you and other school superintendents and CEOs have the caliber staff, the teachers and the principals that you need to get the job done?
Well, let me tell you how much the caliber of the staff is improving here in Chicago. You may remember a couple years ago here in Illinois, there are all these dire warnings about the impending teacher shortage and doom and gloom reports coming out of various universities. Well, over the last 4 years, we've gone from 9,000 applicants to the Chicago Public Schools to 12,000 to 15,000, and in this past fall in September, 17,000. So we actually had 17,000 applicants for about 1,700 jobs. We had 10 applicants for every position, and 42% of whom we hired this year have masters. So there's never been a greater pool of talent coming in, and that pool of talent has never been more highly qualified. So part of the progress we're seeing, and part of the reason I'm so hopeful going forward, is we're seeing remarkably talented people come in, again, not just to our schools in the wealthier neighborhoods, but come into the heart of the inner city and look to make a difference. Of the 1,700 teachers we hired, over 450 of those came through alternative certification routes. And these are people who are very talented, often whom are taking 50, 60, 70% pay cuts, but they want to come into public schools. They want to make a difference in our students' lives. I've never felt better about our talent pool. And again, so much of the progress is due simply to that, putting great teachers, great principals into our classrooms and schools across the city.
And are they staying?
That's actually the bigger challenge. And I think we always try to be very self-critical. I think our HR team has done an extraordinary job of recruiting great talent. And absolutely, the tougher challenge and probably the more important challenge is keeping that great talent. As you know, historically, too many teachers, and I would say too many good teachers, left very early on in their careers, you know, 1 year, 2 year, 3 years in. They didn't feel supported. They didn't feel listened to. They didn't have the classroom management skills they needed. And so we're tracking every single year our retention rates, our ability to keep these teachers. I'm proud of the fact that we're getting better and better, and we're losing less teachers and less young teachers each year, but we still have a ways to go in that. And so we're working very hard to continue to improve our mentoring and induction programs. We have some really innovative partnerships with some of the local universities. And each year, I'm holding myself accountable and our entire team accountable for doing a better job of supporting this great young talent once they come to Chicago.
Arnie, a number of programs have been advanced as the answer to what ails America's schools, and I want you to give me your opinion of a number of them. Charter schools.
First of all, there is no one answer. I wish there was. I wish it was that simple, but anybody who says there's one answer is not being honest, and the issues and the challenges we're dealing with are very, very complex. But to take each one that you ask about, I'm a big fan of charter schools. I'm a fan of creating great new options in neighborhoods that have been underserved. As you're probably aware, here in Chicago, we have a very ambitious and controversial plan, our Renaissance 2010 initiative, to create 100 great new schools in Chicago, particularly in neighborhoods that, one, where performance has been poor historically, and two, where communities are facing overcrowding issues. Of those 100 new schools, we want to create at least a third of them, I want to be charter schools. So I'm a big fan of charters. I'm a big fan of providing a range of choices and opportunities for parents and students to select from, and adding some market competition. I think that's very, very healthy.
How about elected parent boards? Are they important? Do they make a difference?
Well, it goes at two levels. We have an appointed board that I report to, a board of trustees. I think it's important that that board be appointed so that they're not representing a special interest group. You don't have the white board member, the black board member, the Latino board member, the gifted board member, the special ed board member. Our board members are able to really see the whole picture, not represent a single constituency, but represent the entire district, represent the good for all children. So I think the board's leading districts should and need to be appointed boards, and that is more the exception than the norm across the country. And again, I think that's part of the reason public education has struggled. Here in Chicago, we have locally elected local school councils that help to govern and manage the individual schools, and having that parental voice at the table, I think, is critically important. Our local school councils are made up of parents, of teachers, and community members. And historically, too many of our schools were islands. They were isolated from the neighborhood in which they're in. And having that local voice, I think, has been very, very important in the progress and in the improvement we've seen here in Chicago.
What kinds of decisions are they able to make?
The local school councils have very significant authority. They hire and fire and evaluate the principals. Our schools here in Chicago have significant discretionary dollars, and they determine how those dollars are spent and help to set the school's school improvement plan. And so they're making major decisions that impact student achievement and impact how resources are allocated. Resources are always scarce, and again, it's so important that we use every dollar wisely. So they're very significant decisions and power that local school councils hold.
How about small schools? You've got the Gates Foundation, absolutely convinced that small schools make a big difference.
Yeah, the Gates Foundation has been extraordinarily generous to us here in Chicago. I'm a huge fan of small schools. I think the large American high school is absolutely broken at its core. I think it does not begin to work, particularly in inner-city neighborhoods, and in fact has guaranteed social failure for students. Where you have 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 students in a school, students are little more than numbers, and there's a sense of being anonymous. There's a sense that no adult cares about you. What we're creating here is a whole series of high schools that have 400, 500, 600 students in them, where you have 100 to 150 students in a given grade. And so that a team of teachers, 5, 6, 7 teachers, can know those students intimately, can know what's going well for them, can know what their challenges are at home and in the community. If a child misses a day of school, someone's calling and checking on them. They're not slipping through the cracks. And you're starting to see in our small schools, dropout rates go down dramatically. Attendance is up dramatically. Student achievement is continuing to rise. And as we create more great high schools here in Chicago, we are only doing them in a small fashion.
Let me ask you about one more structural improvement that some have recommended. We had Chris Whittle on our show some months ago when his new book came out, And he advocates substantially increased pay for teachers and principals and offsetting that with some other changes in schools. What's your opinion about substantially increased pay?
I think he's fundamentally right. I think we as a society absolutely undervalue in a number of ways, and compensation just being one of them. We undervalue the extraordinary work that great teachers and great principals do. And we have many students in Chicago who come from difficult home situations. We have a large homeless population. In fact, fully 85% of our students live below the poverty line. And you have teachers, you have principals who go way beyond the call of duty, who are literally saving our children on a daily basis. And I think we as a society, again, don't begin to value the hard work they do. I think too often where you have a couple bad teachers, they blemish the record or the reputation of those that are doing a fantastic job. And where you have teachers who aren't getting the job done, aren't helping students well, we need to move them out because we can't have any adult hurting a child or holding back on their potential. But where you have talented and committed adults making a difference every single day, they are absolutely undervalued. And if we had the resources, I would love to pay them more.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Arne Duncan. He is CEO of Chicago Public Schools. Has no child left behind been a plus or a minus?
That's a great question. We could go on and on for that. A couple quick thoughts on it. The philosophy of No Child Left Behind, I absolutely support. The annual testing, we test our students annually and have been doing that for many, many years. The idea of providing students with a range of high-quality options and choices, and again, we're creating 100 great new schools here in Chicago and trying to provide a new menu of options that's never existed before. The emphasis on highly qualified teachers, we actually have a higher standard here in Chicago than a No Child Left Behind law. So the premise and the philosophy behind No Child Left Behind, I like. I think there's been more flexibility with Secretary Spellings, and we've developed a very good working partnership. So I've been pleased with that. A couple critiques of the No Child Left Behind law, the idea of providing choice to students and moving them out of their schools before you provide the after-school program, the supplemental services, I think that's backwards. And probably my largest critique is that you have many schools in urban areas like Chicago, in tough communities, where you're seeing real improvement year over year, where test scores are going from the 28th percent to the 31st, to the 35th, to the 38th. Where you're seeing progress, I think we need to do everything we can to celebrate the hard work that's going on there, recognize the improvement, and reward it. Too often, the No Child Left Behind actually stigmatizes those schools that are improving and labels them as failing. And I think that can be very demoralizing to staff and confusing to parents. And I think over time, as that No Child Left Behind Act gets reauthorized, really looking at student gain and is progress being made, those are the real questions. We actually close schools here in Chicago for academic failure, which is very tough and hard to do, but I think is the right thing to do and come back and create great new schools. And so I'm all for real accountability. We welcome that and really have tried to set a very, very high bar for ourselves here in Chicago. What I don't like, again, however, is where schools that are actually improving, that are doing great work in tough communities, get labeled as failures. There's something fundamentally wrong with that.
But how did we end up, Arne, at 28% passing test in the first place?
I think a number of reasons. I think there's been a tremendous historic underinvestment in schools. There has been a lack of accountability, and I think expectations have been far too low. To see today here in Chicago, eighth graders, again, where 85% of our students live below the poverty lines, the majority of our eighth graders are actually beating national norms in reading now. Our high school's test scores are starting to rise. So we see every day what students can do when we challenge them, when we really raise the bar. We've been doing a number of focus groups and interviews. I spend a lot of time just actually talking to high school students, and they're basically saying our expectations have been too low. It's fascinating to have these conversations. They're asking for more rigor. They're asking to be challenged. We've seen dramatic increases in the number of students taking and passing AP classes, but we have a heck of a long way to go there. And I just think fundamentally people didn't believe that children or poor children or minority children, whatever it might be, people fundamentally didn't believe they could learn. And again, structurally, school systems were set up for failure. And we're trying to dramatically challenge that status quo and become a great school district here.
As CEO of Chicago Public Schools, what is your biggest headache? Can you be honest about it?
Absolutely. And I'll first say I love this job and feel so unbelievably lucky to have this opportunity. I'm a Chicago kid. I've lived here all my life. And my mother's run an inner-city after-school tutoring program since before I was born. And to have the chance to really try and dramatically improve public education, I can't tell you how lucky I feel to have this chance. Absolutely, my biggest headache is the lack of investment that the state puts into public education here in Illinois. It's definitely not an issue that the current governor created. This has been true for decades. And the current governor has actually worked hard to try and reverse this and has increased funding. But the fact still remains that Illinois is 49th out of 50 states in the amount of money going to public education. It's a dismal funding record. The 50th state is actually Nevada, and they have gaming. They have a different revenue source, so Illinois is actually dead last. And not only are we at the bottom nationally in terms of the amount of money going in, we're 43rd in the country in the disparities between the wealthy districts and the poor districts. And in Chicago and other parts of the state, we get a half to a third of the money that wealthier school districts get in the suburbs. There's something fundamentally wrong and immoral, I would say, that the children of the poor get so much less spent on their education than the children of the rich. Public education has to be the great equalizer. And where children are born into poverty, the only way to get them out is through great education. All the anti-poverty programs, all that kind of thing, to me, is a farce. It doesn't work. You have to have our students graduate from high school. They have to be able to go on to college. And if we could ever dramatically revamp the funding structure here in Illinois, you'd see not just the Chicago Public Schools, but the entire state here go to a new level.
Why haven't you and Mayor Daley been able to make that case with the state legislature?
I think we're fighting decades of neglect, and change is hard. And I think we're starting to reach a critical mass. The mayor has done an extraordinary job of building a coalition of mayors, a Republican, Democrat, city, suburban, rural. He has over 270 mayors that he's working with on this issue. I've been part of a coalition of 54 superintendents from around the state who are working together, again, crossing through all the geographic diversity of the state. And historically, I think politicians played a pretty good job of pitting Chicago versus the suburbs or versus downstate. And we're really in a state of crisis now, and we're on the same page. So I think we're getting close to that tipping point, that critical mass. We have a gubernatorial election here in Illinois this November, and we're trying to make this the number one issue that all candidates, Republican and Democrats, have, and they have a chance to really make history and do something dramatically better that would reverse, again, decades of neglect. And we want this to be the first issue that whoever's elected governor deals with coming out of the box as we go into the new year.
You've mentioned, I think, two issues. One is the funding formula, how the money gets distributed, and two, the amount of money there is to be distributed. So don't you think that the people of Illinois and the people of the U.S. would in fact step up and fund education if they really believed that the money would produce results?
I think so, and I think historically there has absolutely been a credibility gap, particularly with urban school districts. And what we've tried to do here in Chicago is take away all the excuses. And I don't even call them the excuses. There were real challenges. If you go back here in Chicago 20 years, going back to 1987, there had been 9 strikes in 17 years. So parents never knew when schools were going to be open. Well, we have a contract that runs through 2007, and at that point would have had 20 years of labor peace. Historically, I think budgets were absolutely mismanaged, and you know, districts lurched from crisis to crisis. We've had 10 years of balanced budgets since the mayor took over. We've reduced administrative costs to 4.6% of the overall budget, and we're trying to drive every dollar into the classroom, you know, during the school day, after school, and be absolutely fiscally responsible. And then historically, student performance was dismal, was absolutely dismal. Again, going back here in Chicago 10, 11 years ago, it's actually staggering. Almost half our students, 48% of our students, were testing in the bottom quartile. Well, over the last 10 years, we've cut that number in half, and in fact, we're doing better than national averages now, and down to about 23% of students in the bottom quartile. And in fact, as I said earlier, eighth graders are actually beating national norms. So we've tried to remove every excuse, whether it's student achievement, which is at all-time highs, whether it's being fiscally responsible, whether it's maintaining labor peace and stability. We've tried to remove every excuse for not funding public education, saying this is the right investment to make. But again, I think what we have to do is prepare our students not just to be successful here in Chicago, but to be able to compete, obviously, in a national and an international economy. And here we have a 180-day school year. I think the school year is way too short. I think the school day is too short. You look at places like India and China and some of these emerging countries where students are going to school 220, 230 days. those countries are simply placing a value on education and developing their young people that we have not had the courage or the wisdom or the foresight to do here in the United States. And I worry a lot about our country's long-term competitive advantage unless we start doing the right thing by children at an early age.
Arnie, thanks so much for talking with us today on Smart City.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate the opportunity.
Arnie Duncan is CEO of Chicago Public Schools. After a short break, we'll return to talk with Eric Schwartz of Citizen Schools, and we'll talk to Otis White about the latest news from cities. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Otis White runs Civic Strategies in Atlanta, and each week he brings us urban insights from around the country. Since A Nation at Risk was published, 25 years ago, perhaps, there have been hundreds of ideas advanced as the silver bullet to fix what ails America's schools. You found another one. It's called the Edmonton Model.
Yeah. And you're right to characterize it this way. It has been tried in one place. It seems to be successful there. It'll be interesting to see if it works elsewhere. It is getting a trial in a new place, which is Washington, D.C. Now, first, why is it called the Edmonton Model? Because it's the way the public schools are run in Edmonton, Alberta, which is in Canada. Here's the basic idea. The school system divides up its budget and gives allocations to the schools, and it allows each individual principal to have spending decisions over 95% of the budget for that school. Now, so what does that mean? It means that if the principal can buy supplies for that school cheaper at Office Depot than by going down to the school system and buying it, or it can get janitorial services cheaper through some private company as opposed to working through the school system's janitorial service itself, then that principal is absolutely allowed to go out and do this. Sounds very free market. Conservatives love it. They think this is going to greatly increase the efficiency of schools by creating some competition within the school system. So it's one of those things that conservatives seem to love, but it does tie into something else that seems to be going on in the schools that's worth noting, which is a great deal more power is given to principals these days than they were when you and I were in school. As principals then were, more or less human resource managers. Today, they're real managers, as in financial managers, and they do outreach into their communities and so on. So the principal is becoming a much more important figure in individual schools, I think, than was the case 20, 30 years ago.
I'm curious whether today's principals are indeed prepared to take on this responsibility, both in terms of background and, just as important, if not more so, in terms of the way the job is organized. I mean, I haven't been responsible for purchasing, and now you make me responsible for purchasing, that's a big responsibility.
It is, and this is, you put your finger on it, this is the great transition. If anything like this ever becomes successful, we have to have a completely different kind of principal, maybe not even a professional educator who runs these schools in the future. Then the mind kind of boggles as to what kind of person you'd seek to run schools if it's not someone who used to be a teacher.
Well, it's one more fix to watch, and to watch as it rolls out over a number of schools to see if it can get traction. Otis, we'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, Carol.
You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Eric Schwartz is president and CEO of Citizen Schools. Prior to founding Citizen Schools, Eric worked as vice president for organizational development and later as executive director of City Year Boston. He is a graduate of the University of Vermont and earned his master's at the Harvard University Graduate School of Education. Eric, what was your inspiration for Citizen Schools?
Well, I think it was a combination of frustration with the pace of education reform and a real sense that a lot of kids, in fact, millions of kids, were being left behind every year. Every year in America, 4 million children start ninth grade, and every year only about 3 million graduate from 12th grade. So we're losing 1 million kids every year. My sense was that we were trying so hard as a country to change all that through focusing on school reform, and we weren't paying enough attention to all the time that kids spend out of school. Kids are awake about 5,000 hours a year. They're only in school for 1,000 hours. So I wanted to build a movement that would really take advantage of the out-of-school hours and get citizens involved, get lawyers and architects and chefs and grandmothers who know how to sew directly involved with kids and sharing their skills and sharing their passions. And that's what we've tried to do through Citizen Schools.
Well, tell me how Citizen Schools works.
It gives kids, middle school kids is our focus, a chance to work with the most talented professionals and tradespeople from the community through an apprenticeship model. So kids are in the program 4 afternoons a week from when school gets out at about 2 in the afternoon until 6 p.m. And in addition to homework and field trips to college campuses and museums and help building their leadership skills and their academic skills, they get a chance a couple times a week to work with some of the community's most talented professionals. As an example, working with a web designer to build their school's website, or working with an architect to redesign their school's public garden or outdoor space, or working with a lawyer to prepare for arguing a mock trial. And along the way, they're able to build both an appreciation of the joys of work as well as academic skills that come in context because they've learned them through sort of hands-on, real-world projects.
How do students come to Citizen Schools?
We go into the schools. Our programs are all based in high-need public schools, and we really go classroom by classroom recruiting kids. And we get a lot of referrals from both schools and teachers as well as parents. Our kids tend to be a little more at risk than the average public school kid, and many kids who are struggling in school find their way into Citizen Schools, and a good number of them start succeeding in school after some time in the program. Basically, they sign up first come, first serve.
And so the program is, in effect, housed in public schools, so they go, children leave school and go nowhere. They simply come to another classroom. Is that what happens?
Exactly. So the bell will ring at 2 o'clock, and some of the kids from the school will go home, and others who are in Citizen Schools will then stay until dinner time. And while we use the school as kind of the home base, we like to think of the city as sort of a classroom without walls. And so we bring kids often out to law firms, out to museums, out to college campuses, out to architectural firms, and they really get to experience the whole city and do their learning on the move around the city as well as in their classrooms that they've already been in during the day.
And how do you find architects and lawyers and landscape architects who work with the students in Citizen Schools?
Well, it's interesting. You know, we started and we thought that the biggest limiter to growth would be, you know, could we find enough volunteers, the people we call citizen teachers, to work with our kids? And that hasn't been the case. We've found really an outpouring of interest and an outpouring of support from people, mostly young professionals, who want to connect and want to work with young people and want to make a difference and want to address the achievement gap and want to enrich their own lives in powerful ways. And what they need is they need support, they need structure, and they need training. And Citizen Schools has developed a real methodology for training and supporting these volunteer citizen teachers and creating an incredibly enriching and, I think, professionally developing experience for them.
What do citizen teachers really need to know to be effective with Citizen School students?
They need to know the field that they're passionate about. And for some lawyers, to take an example, you know, they went into the law passionate about justice and passionate about constitutional issues. And over time, sometimes they have found that they're more focused on the nitty-gritty of dotting I's and crossing T's. And what Citizen Schools can do is reawaken why they went into that profession in the first place and give them a chance to sort of share some of their passion for that field with young people. And along the way, learn about how kids who are definitely a different age and maybe a different race and maybe a different economic background learn about them and really share cross-culturally with them both their own experiences as well as learning from the young people in the program.
What sort of time commitment do you expect or is required by a volunteer citizen teacher?
It's one afternoon a week from roughly 3 to 5 p.m. for 11 straight weeks. So it's a fairly intense time commitment while you're doing it. We find the people who sign up or make up the time at work by coming earlier the next day or, you know, staying later that same night. And it's really high-performing professionals who tend to be the folks who sign up for this. The good thing is it's a time-limited commitment. You sign up for it. You do it for 11 weeks. You may come back and do it the next semester, or you may not. You may pass the baton to someone else in your office. But we find there's a lot of people who want to connect in that way, want to take that time. It's about, you know, 40 or 50 hours, including the preparation and training time, to really make a difference for 10 kids. Because the model is it's two or three adults working with 10 kids in a class over those 11 weeks.
Why do you focus on middle school students?
That's a great question. I did some, I guess, informal research 12, 15 years ago among a lot of young adults who dropped out of high school. And I asked them when they had dropped out, and, you know, almost to a person, it was, you know, either right after ninth grade or after 10th grade that they physically dropped out of school, usually when they turned 16 years old. And then I asked them, well, when did you sort of mentally drop out? And all of them talked about the middle school years. And in many cases, they had left a sort of supportive environment in elementary school, gone to middle school, where the bell was ringing every 45 minutes. They were moving and didn't have a homeroom teacher, but moving from class to class to class. And for many kids, that was the point at which they mentally dropped out of school, and physically they left, you know, a couple of years later. It's an age when kids are, you know, too old for arts and crafts only, or certainly too old for babysitting after school, too young to work. They're at an age where Eric Erickson, the psychologist, talks about the challenge and the choices that kids make or that people make at every stage in their life. And the challenge for pre-adolescence and early adolescence is sort of a choice between a sense of industry and a sense of inferiority. And I think citizen schools gives kids a sense of industry, a sense of being productive, a sense of producing things of value for their community, which is just psychologically incredibly important at that age. And lastly, it's a point at which kids are pushing their parents away. You know, even kids with great parents, which most kids do, you know, do have great parents who love them, kids are pushing parents away and looking for outside influences. And it's particularly important at that middle school age that you have really positive outside influences helping to shape children.
Do children and their families pay to participate in citizen schools?
You know, when we started, we had a sort of small fee on a sliding scale. And it's gotten down to be either none in about half of our sites around the country, no fee at all, or minimal. So they pay, it counts for less than 5% of our revenue and of our costs.
Do you require anything of either the parents or the students? I mean, in terms of a commitment to behave in a certain way or a commitment by parents to make sure children do something. I'm just curious about the social compact, if you will, for participation in citizen schools versus, well, it's a very convenient babysitting service for me as a parent.
We are trying to get some of the most at-risk young people who are often failing in school and have parents who are working incredibly hard and aren't around as much as they'd like to be for their kids. So we have to be careful not to ask so much that we would cut out some of the kids that we most want to serve. What we do ask, one, is that kids show up regularly. This is not a drop-in program. And we are fortunate to have very high attendance at an age when it's hard to have very high attendance. But our kids are consistently there, and that's something that we really insist upon. With parents, we, you know, try to basically reach out to them and invite them in. So what we do with parents is we call them every week and try to catch their kids doing things right. Invite the parents in to see the kids performing at the WOW events that every apprenticeship culminates in, and ask the parents to sort of be involved in very positive ways, which is a change for them because they often have had negative experiences in school, haven't had time during the school day to be able to talk with the teachers. And so for us to be able to call them at night, if they speak primarily a non-English language, talk to them in their language, and then invite them in to see their kids being successful in the late afternoon or even in the evening where some of our events are, that's a positive way to get them engaged.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Eric Schwartz. He's president and CEO of Citizen Schools. You mentioned the WOW event. You have me curious. What is that?
Every apprenticeship, and we've now done about 4,000 apprenticeships since we started Citizen Schools in 1995, every apprenticeship is two or three adults working with about 10 kids over 11 weeks to make something amazing. And at the end of those 11 weeks, we want to showcase that product or that performance. So if it's a team of lawyers working with the kids to argue a mock trial, the WOW is a mock trial in front of a federal judge with his or her black robes on, with a jury box filled with civic leaders, and the kids there, often in their Sunday best clothes, arguing a case, much like you would in law school in front of that real-life jury and real-life judge and parents and others looking on. In the case of architecture, it's kids who've worked with leading architects presenting their designs for a civic space in their city at a local school of architecture, or maybe in front of at City Hall in front of the mayor and other leaders. In the case of financial services, we have people from Fidelity and Smith Barney and Goldman Sachs who've worked with kids to develop an investment plan for real live clients who might be a teacher at their school who's trying to save money to send his or her son to college. And so the WOW will be the kids presenting investment advice to that real life client at the Federal Reserve Bank or another public venue. The idea is to have kids do work that makes adults say, wow, I can't believe kids were capable of that. I didn't know they were capable of that. And give the kids both confidence, deserved confidence, and a sense of being a producer who has something to offer to their community.
Eric, that's a great idea. I'm sorry. Citizen Schools wasn't around when I was in school. There are thousands of programs, though, Eric, serving young people in this country. But the real action, the real dollars, go to schools. Do you imagine your work will influence schools to change the way they deal with children or educate children? Are you actively working toward that?
We are hoping that, you know, Citizen Schools can kind of open the way to schools improving. And partly that's sharing an idea around hands-on learning that schools could do more of. Partly it's making their jobs easier by getting parents more involved, by continuing the learning after the bell rings, and by supporting young people in doing their homework and building good study skills. I also believe that we're not going to address the achievement gap in this country, which is holding us back from greatness as a nation, if we just look to schools to address it. We do need to find a way to kind of broaden the playing field, get other citizens involved, and make better use of all the potential learning time when kids aren't in school. So I think as a country, we've been trying very hard to change schools. We've made some gains, but not gone as far as we'd like to go. And we need to do a lot more to open up really positive learning experiences in the afternoons, the evenings, the weekends, and the summer.
How many children do you currently serve, and in how many markets?
We currently serve 2,000 children in depth. We work with them about 400 to 500 hours per year, and 2,000 children each year across 12 cities across the country.
Are you in an expansion mode?
We are. You know, we spent the first 7 years since we started in 1995 focused just in Boston. We've expanded to now six other cities in Massachusetts, and we're now in California, we're in Texas, New Jersey, opening up in North Carolina this next year, and are looking to add at least one new state each of the next 4 or 5 years. We want to grow very steadily, get to the point of being in 100 schools by 2010, and then build that into citizen schools over the next generation or two or three generations, really becoming a part of the fabric of education across this country. I think ideally most middle schools in the country should host a citizen schools program that could extend learning and bring citizens into their kids' lives throughout the country, and eventually that's what we'd like to see.
It's not easy to expand a program like yours. What are the challenges you've run into as you've expanded citizen schools to 12 cities?
Big part of the challenge is fundraising and how do you raise the money. In the for-profit world, if you develop a better mousetrap and you develop a product that has great evaluation results, and I should say Citizen Schools has been externally evaluated. We're in the middle of a very deep external evaluation, and we're getting very strong results. And kids just 1 year in the program are outperforming a comparison group of kids on 6 out of 7 school-related indicators. Our kids are going on to college-track high schools by a 2-to-1 margin compared to a comparison group. So we're getting very good results. In the for-profit sector, you would expect that would lead lots of investors and lots of consumers to say, we want this and we want to invest in it. That doesn't happen quite the same way in the nonprofit world, where there's more of a focus on sort of starting new things and trying out new innovations. So it's not easy to get the money to grow, even with a strong track record. And that's, I think, one of the biggest challenges to growth. The other challenges are more common challenges to any business, you know, hiring great staff, building in systems for continuous learning, building a great board, developing the right strategy. And we think we're on the right track in all those areas. We've certainly made some mistakes, but we're learning from them.
What excites you about your work, Eric?
I'm excited by the vision of opening up the American dream to a whole lot more people. I'm excited by just the kind of collision of the idealism and awkward, sort of fun-loving energy of a middle school kid kind of colliding with the wisdom, knowledge, and intelligence of a young professional, and together really developing a great learning experience. I'm excited to enrich the professional lives of many citizen teachers and to open up opportunity, both educationally and economically, for a lot of children who don't otherwise have it.
If you could recall one moment where you thought, this has all been worth it, what would that moment be?
I remember at the end of the first summer of citizen schools, we went through a stretch of about six straight days of 100-plus degree weather. Myself and the rest of the staff was tired. We had just been launching this new program. We were hoping it was working pretty well, but it's always hard that first year. And I sat around a table in a mercifully air-conditioned room with about seven moms of kids in our program. And just hearing them talk about what their kids were bringing home from the program, and how every one of them was having the experience of their 12-year-old children kind of pushing them away as parents. And they were so desperately hopeful that the kids would find something positive to latch onto. And they were seeing that happening within citizen schools. And the stories they told about the kids and their experience in the apprenticeships and their positive experience in citizen schools just in that very first year made it worth it. And, you know, since then, it's been those experiences talking to graduates, talking to parents, talking to the volunteer citizen teachers and the staff even, that really give me a sense that we're on the right track and we've got an idea that has a lot of staying power.
You're a graduate of the Harvard University Graduate School of Education. What have you learned in running citizen schools that they didn't teach you at Harvard, or perhaps even runs counter to what you were taught at Harvard?
For one, just the power of out-of-school learning is a relatively new concept that I think most of the universities have been, you know, gradually coming to. But I think we have a paradigm in this country that equates learning with school for obvious reasons. And yet I think if you look back 150 years to an earlier time in this country's history, more young people learn to read in Sunday schools or in sort of home learning societies than learn to read in school. So we have actually a rich tradition of out-of-school learning in this country through settlement houses and Sunday schools and all kinds of other venues. But we have gotten stuck, I think, in recent years with equating learning with formal learning in school. And I think we need to think differently about the roles that museums can play, that television and radio and technology and the internet can play, that after-school programs and mentoring, the role that those organizations can play as well.
Eric, I wish you much continued success with the program. I love what you're doing at Citizen Schools. Eric Schwartz is president and CEO of Citizen Schools. Thanks so much for being with us on Smart City.
Thank you very much for having me.
I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. City View's commentator Walker Smith says protecting public space is vital to creating community.
The emotional comforts of connection are more important than ever, particularly in a world of global terrorism, shrinking safety nets, and economic uncertainties. People are turning to one another for the guidance they no longer trust government or business to provide. And more than ever, people are searching for fulfillment and happiness, something that comes mostly from personal relationships. In his acclaimed turn-of-the-millennium book, The Loss of Happiness in Market Democracies, emeritus Yale political scientist Robert Lane chronicled the rise of unhappiness in the midst of ever-increasing material superabundance. Lane noted that the time required to amass and manage our unprecedented wealth takes time away from personal relationships. In this trade-off, Lane concluded, lies the root source of the growing discontent and spiritual unease that is measurably afflicting Western developed nations. No surprise, then, that in recent years people have started reconnecting. People are discovering on their own what social scientists have known for decades, that above a modest threshold, there is no correlation between money and happiness. Not that anybody wants to give up his or her nice stuff to find fulfillment. Far from it. People want happiness in addition to nice stuff. connecting on the grid, not off the grid, but connecting. And yet, paradoxically, this revival of connections does not presage a renewal of community or a strengthening of social cohesion. Connections are not necessarily community. Despite what some hopeful observers have read into this trend, we are actually seeing a paradox in the contemporary phenomenon of connections without community. Parker Palmer, honored in 1998 as one of the decade's 10 key agenda setters in education, captured the essence of community in the title of his classic 1981 book, The Company of Strangers. Community is not just about connections with intimate associates. It is mostly about public life or living in the company of strangers. The turnaround of interest in connections has been about the character of private life and private interactions, not about civic engagement. It is about living together in private instead of living alone in private, not about a renewed interest in public spaces or in civic community. The challenge for cities is renewing the relevance of community in an era in which connectedness is about the private, not the public domain. The emerging threat is not the old one addressed by Palmer of the private domain of self replacing the public domain of others, but a new one in which people find the connections they want without any need of community. Cities have always been a medley of competing interests, but if current trends continue, the public space will suffer dramatically. Cities must remember that it is not enough to protect and support the private interest of its citizens. For cities to thrive, they must ensure that their citizens understand the personal value of living in the company of strangers. Only then will community find a home in the intensely personal world of tomorrow. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to sign up for podcasts of our show and register for our weekly newsletter. You can also find archive shows at our site. Our theme music was composed and performed by Memphis musicians Robbie Grant and Steve Selvage, with additional music by Christopher Reyes. Candace Ludlow edits Smart City. Smart City is a production of WKNO in Memphis. I'm Carol Coletta.
National distribution of Smart City is made possible by the listeners of WKNO in Memphis and by the Hyde Family Foundation, investing in enlightened leadership, transforming the future of children and community.